Well, happy Wednesday, you good people. It's Wednesday. It's peak off Wednesday. It's time once again for me to join James Valiant to talk about keeping it real. We want to bring ideas down to earth. We want to use Leonard Peikoff's answers to questions in his podcast to bring our ideas down to earth. Now, down to earth, James Valiant, how are you doing this morning?
I am doing quite well. Still glowing from yesterday, of course, but and so forgive my sort of still glowing state. But I had a lovely day yesterday, and I from what I can tell, you did as well.
I did. It was magnificent. I hope everybody had a fine Valentine's Day, whether you have romance in your life or you just spent time with your children, parents, whoever it was. It was a very good day, kind of spiritual refueling. In fact, let's talk about that spiritual fuel, for example, that we get from seeing a site of achievement or from seeing great art or from romance. Well, spiritual, doesn't that sound a little bit woo? I don't think so, but we need better answers than I can give on that subject.
Yeah, Leonard can give much better answers, I think, than I could ever give.
And we need it because, let's put it out there, don't we live in a miserable world? In fact, Leonard Peikoff was asked that question, so I will jump right to question number one. How do I stay happy in a miserable world? And it's a great question, and we could easily do a whole hour on this, but Leonard Peikoff gives a very long answer. I'll excerpt a bit. He starts with, I get this question in different forms all the time, and I don't know how to satisfy it. First of all, and he says, because this was, if you listen to the live version of the question, he asked about depression and anger. He says, first of all, I don't equate depression with anger. Depression comes from giving up. You feel that you can't do anything, your values are lost, what's the point? And you can feel that way temporarily. I think anger is a much better emotion to feel, because the idea of anger is that it is intolerable and must be wiped out. In a way, it's the opposite of depression. If you have to choose between the two, I'd choose the angry side and do what you can to fight the thing that is making you angry. I think we can agree with that. But then he goes into, and my favorite part of the answer here, of course, the best policy is to be neither depressed nor angry, but self-sufficient in exactly the way that Howard Roark is portrayed in The Fountainhead. On a scale not involving the corruption of the whole world or the whole country, he is someone who meets obstacle after obstacle, failure after failure, the destruction and defeat of his values. But he doesn't become depressed or angry because he's too selfish. Now, I'll stop there, James, but I see by the smile on your face that that's resonating with you as well.
Completely, completely, completely. We can, if we, and here, the reason why it plugs into the spiritual here is that really the answer is, you know, I don't mean to sound like a Buddhist or a Stoic, because obviously the physical and existential circumstances in which we live will have an impact on how we can succeed, in fact, in our workings and dealings with reality. If you live in a socialist country or you live in a dictatorship, there are going to be all kinds of challenges to your life. If you live in a culture that has a bankrupt nihilist culture, it's going to be hard to find even spiritual values that do that. And so I don't want to sound like a Stoic or a Buddhist, but it begins on the inside. I'm not going to tell you to stop wanting, stop desiring, stop seeking, stop taking emotional risks. No, it requires all that too. But happiness does start from the inside. What are you doing about it? What are you going to, how are you going to react to it? It's our own internal reaction. Howard Roark had something that was super fulfilling in his life. And he was going to do that. And he was going to do that at whatever scale he could do it. And he was going to get incredible joy from it, even if it was a gas station that he was left to build. Okay, I'll build that gas station. It'll be the coolest gas station ever designed. And he'll get this incredible satisfaction from, even if the world has limited him to gas stations, he has this spiritual core that permits him to find all the joy he needs in life from what he can do, starting with his own attitude, starting with his own attitude. Of course, we face injustice. And sometimes we face irreconcilable loss. We can't avoid all anger and depression. And an anger and depression are sometimes the appropriate response. sad that we should have to do that. But the point is, if we don't focus on that, we focus on what we can do, what our values are, then at whatever scale the circumstances we find ourselves in, we can be happy. We can have a rewarding, we can get the spiritual values we can from whatever level of material success we can achieve. And at some point, though, it drops off, obviously in a dictatorship or a concentration camp, obviously as a slave. That kind of happiness is impossible, even to a Howard Rourke. But notice, Howard Rourke can be fully satisfied with designing a gas station.
Yes, it's beautiful. And for folks who've heard Sunday shows that I do with Amy, 5 Minutes with Robert and Amy Nace, or the Thursday shows, Life on Earth, you've heard me say before, if you are constantly angry, constantly depressed, and if you're letting the state of the world distract you from achieving your values, that is a failure of selfishness. So I love that Leonard Peikoff says, in regard to Howard Rourke, he doesn't become depressed or angry because he's too selfish. He's too wrapped up in himself and in his work. If he wanted a crusade, he very well could, but that wasn't relevant to the novel. He would do it. Then he would be involved in what he's doing and what doing what he can. Incidentally, by the end of the novel, he does take action, both in regard to that
building
that went up, and also he's willing to go to court and speak out. So it's not that he's a stoic and says, well, whatever comes my way.
Not at all. And it does depend on, happiness depends upon our ambition, our caring, our being non-stoic and non-Buddhist, if you will, in that respect.
Oh, yeah, well, you've given us a question that'll address exactly that shortly.
No.
Outstanding. And I love, too, that Leonard Peikoff understands how this perspective is different depending on your age. He says, I think part of it is your age, how depressed and angry you get. I remember when I was young, Leonard Peikoff speaking, and I saw the whole world and I decided I was going to be a crusader because I felt, well, this is intolerable. I think anyone interested in rational ideas, if they're young, should feel the same way, assuming their work gives them the time to do it. Anyone who's young and at all idealistic feels, well, this world is bad. It has to be fought. You have the enthusiasm and the self-esteem of youth. I certainly felt. I don't care how many other things people have already achieved and how young I am, I'm going to make a huge difference. He says, I have a different attitude now. I won't say how many decades later. The main thing I know right now is that I didn't know then is what time scale is involved in changing the world. In the beginning, well, I actually thought that Atlas Shrugged would come out. People would read it. And I know we're talking about it, all agree, and then that would be utopia. Now, many decades later, I know we're talking about a change that takes a long time, generations to generations.
And what a funny story that. What a funny story.
What a great point.
Oh, totally. And there's a funny story behind that. When Leonard first read Atlas Shrugged back in the 1950s, when he completed the book, he announced, the culture is cooked. It's done. We're over. It's all downhill from here. The world will recognize the innovation, genius, revolutionary impact of Ayn Rand's ideas. And it's down to, well, how long will it take? Maybe by next week, we'll be living in a utopia, you know. And Ayn Rand's response was kind of, no.
I love that she told Leonard, you know, that that's simplistic, over optimistic, but she, right. Then she did say, but if this book sells 100,000 copies, this culture is cooked.
Right.
I love that she also had that optimism.
Yeah, way more than that, of course. It's still in continuous hard paperback print, you know, over 60 years later. So that's got to say something. But, you know, the truth is there are a lot of people who get bogged down in news stories and the state of the world, and they let circumstances beyond their control, maybe even circumstances thousands of miles away, or certainly political and economic circumstances that, as I say, they have no effective control over, and they will get depressed about that and paralyzed from taking any positive action in their own life. Now, if it reaches that kind of state of, frankly, disability, then obviously you're being totally unselfish. You've got to treat, Ayn Rand says this in The Metaphysical versus the Man-Made so eloquently, sometimes we have to treat our social conditions or the actions of other people as metaphysical, in effect, metaphysical facts. Sure, I would like to change their attitudes and change their future behavior, but what's happened has happened. It is carved in stone as a metaphysical absolute. And the current condition of our culture and people will require a process of learning and growing and coming to understand Ayn Rand's ideas that cannot happen automatically or overnight. So if you're obsessed with bad news and you watch the news and you find yourself, your own motivation being affected by it, definitely there's something wrong there. You've got to be able to stand on your own, make within your own arm's reach, your own life, your friends, your work, you can create for yourself. I don't mean to say a bubble in a miserable world of happiness, but at least a comparatively extreme difference in your context, which is rational. I know I've done this to some extent in my life with the friends I've selected, the things I do, the art I look at, and most importantly, my own creative work. Those things can be a source of tremendous happiness and self-satisfaction. If I were to focus on the state of the world and to have that affect my creation of this private world of happiness, like Howard Roark, I would be totally unselfish. Be as happy as you can be, people. Don't let the world bog you down. Don't let circumstances beyond your control paralyze you from finding the happiness you can find in this world.
Outstanding. And it is a challenge. It is a bit of a balancing act. Leonard Peikoff ends his answer with this. He says, it really is an impossible question. Now listen to this. I know you know this, James, but everybody, it struck me. It's one of the, you sometimes read something and it hits you in the head like a fist or a brick. He says, it really is an impossible question. How can I be happy in today's, as happy in today's world? How can I be as happy in today's world as I would be in a proper world? Oh, that gets you, because you realize right there, he's set it up. Well, obviously that's ridiculous. You can't be as happy in a damaged world as you can in an ideal world. But how many of us, especially when we were young, approached objectivism in exactly that way, where we thought, well, I can't ignore the world, that would be evasion, but I need to be as happy as it's possible to be in an ideal world? So he says, but you can't be, in the sense of all the pleasures you could get in a proper world. You can be, though, in that fundamental sense of knowing what you are after and being able to achieve it and knowing other people that you care about or love.
That's it.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. And speaking of, well, you know, there's a whole essay on what can one do, how to live a rational life in an irrational world.
Oh, great essay.
Highly recommended. One of the ways that you can do that is you do fight. You don't spend all of your time angry, but you devote a certain amount of resources to it. It's certainly what I do. I call it my 97-3 rule. 3% of my time goes to fighting evil. 97% of my time goes to living the best life I can. But that bit of fighting evil is crucial. It's important. Without that 3%, the 97% would all be evasion. And so in our chat, Jeff Bannister is fighting evil by contributing to the Ayn Rand Center UK. Actually, his super chat question, of which he puts a generous $10 in, says, good morning, and a cup of coffee. So I am all about that. Seriously, though, that bit of fighting evil, part of it is just, if you have any enthusiasm, and Lord knows I do, for the Ayn Rand Center UK, for all the work that happens, for the daily objective, we have programming every single weekday of the week, and study sessions on the weekend, and other study sessions during the week, and exclusive events, and top-tier philosophers, not just like you, James Valiant, but also Harry Binswanger, does a regular show on Mondays. We've got people like Nikos Satyrakopoulos, brilliant, 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 and so many other great hosts. Jonathan Honig just did a great show on love for Valentine's Day. Throw a few dollars in. Feel free. Put in that super chat. Make your comments and your questions stand out. Don't they deserve to? Yes, they do.
Right. We talk about creating a world, your own world, our own context in which we can be happy. And for me, the Ayn Rand Center UK obviously plays an important role, both in what I do, but also provides me values. Like you say, I watched Jonathan yesterday, right? Or I listened to Harry Binswanger. My God, Harry Binswanger. I learn every time the man speaks. They help create this environment that makes the world better for me. And it's serving to help change the world for the better. Again, for promoting my values. So I can only echo. You know, Ayn Rand once said, those who, I hope I don't butcher this quote, those who live for the future and work for the future live in it today.
Those who fight for the future live in it today. Absolutely right. And I've talked about that at length, because when you fight for the future, you're surrounding yourself by your own moral ideals. You know, some people say that, you know, if you live with kindness, you create a kinder world. That's true in a certain way, because if you surround yourself with good people, the kind of people who are drawn to a kind person, your world suddenly takes on that shape. Well, if you fight for the future, if you fight for these ideals, you are living these ideals and you are united with people living these ideals. And after a while, it's kind of hard to even see the evil because you've got all these good people and all of these good actions around you. So I love that you brought that up. He who fights for the future lives in it today. And speaking of which, you know, I have this great passion for people putting in the super chats. And I'll tell you my secret. I'll tell you my secret about super chats. Why does Robert, who's already putting in so much effort for the Ayn Rand Center UK, why does he also super chat? Why does he support the organization? A, because I love and respect what they do. But B, every time you see me super chat, it's just, I'm being cocky. I want my words out there. I want them to stand. It's fun. It's just flat out fun. Well, should you ever do things for fun? In fact, the second question that Leonard Pigott was asked in our list today, if we are to decide our actions by reason and logic, why do we have emotions? Now that's an unusual question. I mean,
well, objectivism so strongly comes down on the basic fact that is basically just a fact. The human mode of reason, the logical integration of the material provided by the senses, is humanity's only way of knowing anything. There can be no knowledge from some mystical means or from some emotional whim because I want it to be true. That is the definition of subjectivity and the quick path to total error and disaster. Our only means of knowledge is reason. So if we're only going to go by reason and logic, if it's only the evidence of my senses as integrated by my conceptual faculty in a logical way, where does that leave room for other things like emotion, intuition, things like that? A perfectly valid question, and one objectivists get all the time.
I'm glad you said emotion and intuition, because the other mistake that sometimes we make, I've made it when I was younger, was thinking, well, we have reason and we have emotions. So those two combined must be the whole of human consciousness.
Human mind has so many different parts and mechanisms and operations. We have values that become emotions. We have memories and memories that help shape our, you know, the human consciousness is a big complex thing, which is more than, strictly speaking, cognition, coming to be aware of something in the world. There's all kinds of ramifications and emanations of that in our soul. So, yeah.
Well, and you used that word because I wanted to bring it up. Yes, our soul. Well, you got to define your terms. Irrational ways to use soul, irrational ways to use spiritual. We'll talk about that in a minute. But yes, we're certainly more than that. But I love the metaphysical implications of this question. Why do we have emotions? Wait a minute. What does that question even mean? Leonard Pigott starts off by saying, well, first of all, what do you mean by why? Do you mean, like, what purpose did God or nature have in mind? All you can ask are, well, what good are emotions? What are their functions? And there are a great many. And I'll give you just a bit of Leonard Pigott's answer here, but you could read the full answer in the book or listen to it online. He says, emotions are, as Ayn Rand has shown in great detail, automatized responses adding up instantaneously all the values you hold in a given situation, thereby applying your value judgments in a situation in which there would not be time to do it if you just simply set it all intellectually. Well, if somebody came to you with a gun and there were no emotions, you know, no fear, and you looked at him and you said, well, yes, life is the standard of value and I am the purpose and man has rights. And by the time you got to the impropriety of force, you would be gone. But the fear, tells you right away, oh, this was a threat to your values. And, you know, he goes on to say, you can't always act on it, though in this type of case, you'd have to, because you may have put wrong content into your emotions. But nevertheless, without their instantaneous appraisal, you couldn't function. Another thing among many is that if there were no emotions, well, you could have no enjoyment of life, satisfaction, fulfillment, all that involves happiness, feeling good, enjoyment, pleasure, and the like, emotions that are utterly indispensable. The thing is, they are not your means of cognition. They don't tell you how much two and two is, or whether Christianity or objectivism is true. But they have many, many crucial functions.
Yeah.
And I'll stop there. He goes on a bit, but that point that...
There's really a good point. Cognition itself is aided by emotions. You know, if I have, you know, a concept, according to objectivism, is an integration of an open-ended number of concretes, a potentially limitless number of concretes. So when I'm confronted with the million examples of every concept I have, or every theory I have, or broader abstraction or inductive generalization I reach, principle I adhere to, if I were to focus on all those concretes, it would blow my crow. My mind cannot hold all the concretes, you know, as concretes. And that's the whole cognitive function of concepts, according to Ayn Rand, so that we can treat as a single concrete unit, this open-ended number of potential instances. What emotions can do is it can zero us in. So if someone tells me something about, say, the evil of force, instantly I have examples, criminals, dictators, boom, this guy pushing this other person. Okay, I've got all these emotions help direct me to the actually probably the most vivid and useful concretes in my own thinking or in a discussion I'm having with someone. They play a role in cognition. They are not cognition. They do not tell us that 1 + 1 = 2. They do not logically generate an inductive generalization. Emotions cannot do that, but they serve a vital role in cognition. And people have to really recognize that as well. Sure, they're only telling us about our own values, but they are telling us about our values. There are means of enjoying life. There are motivation. We would find no joy in life. we would have nothing to motivate us and kick us in the rear end to get us to do the things that will make our lives happy. Because why be happy? Oh, yeah. Okay. Motivation is key. And of course, as Dr. Peikoff says, there are times where we have to rely on our emotions. We have to act instantly, and can't rethink the whole thing. So I have to kind of rely on an emotion. But if we are introspective, if we are aware of our internal contents, if we are familiar with our own emotions, we can trust them, at least in those moments where we need to trust them. But that only stresses the need for introspection and knowing about our own emotions, where they come from, and being confident in the validity of your own emotions. Yeah.
Outstanding. Before the next question, we have another super chat, again from Jeff Bannister, who doubles down on his previous generous contribution. He says, a year ago, I had the 97.3% inverted. And yeah, I know that feeling too. ARCK yeah. has changed that. I am now more about living and learning than fighting. I take some credit for that, but acknowledge the influence of objectivism in that process. Well, that's great. And Jeff, you should take all the credit for that. But yes,
oh, yeah.
Certainly altruism has had a big impact on all of us.
And Jeff, thank you so much, Jeff. But altruism does that to all of us. It'll make it look, altruism can't be lived consistently, can it? But it'll make us feel, so I have to dedicate myself to changing the world. And even if it's a selfish thing in my mind, saving the world, it's still a remnant of altruism, isn't it? And altruism makes us feel guilty, even for that 3% that you previously gave to your own selfish values over changing the world. You see? No. Not only does Robert have, and you now have the appropriate ratio, but it's not a duty. It really is only the pursuit of your own selfish values in reality, even that 3%. And don't let anyone tell you that was altruism, self-sacrifice, and make you feel, you know, guilty about the, you know, 3%, you know, the 97% you spend on your life as opposed to trying to fix the world.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned altruism, because whenever I catch myself looking at the world too simplistically, you know, Amy will remind me of the impact of altruism on our lives. How the road to hell is paved with good intentions, as if altruism is good. People believe it. They believe in self-sacrifice. They believe selfishness is wrong. And you can talk about self-responsibility, and they're all about that. And even self-assurance or self-esteem, self-reliance, all of that sounds very responsible. But the minute you say, well, that's because you yourself are at the center of your own value hierarchy and selfishness is a virtue, they're like, ah, because they believe in altruism. They believe self-sacrifice is a virtue.
Exactly.
So I'm glad that you mentioned that. It's the kind of thing I have to remind myself every now and then. This isn't just about explicit evil, but philosophical evil, that inversion that says, yeah, be altruistic. And you don't even need a moral code beyond that. As long as you're sacrificing, you can count yourself one of the good guys. Ugh. And in that regard, we'll go to question number three here. Is it possible to have a terrible sense of life, but a good philosophy?
That's
before I even get into Leonard's answer, I'm curious, James, what's your reaction to that question?
Well, in one sense, yes. In one sense, no. Definitely yes in one sense, because your sense of life, it reflects your psychology, your automatized value judgments, the judgments, the evaluations you've already built in effect to your soul. So you can be characterized by a sense of life, which is the expression of philosophy, in effect. What objectivism calls sense of life are those emotions which come from your basic philosophical perspective. And that can be automatized. It can even be automatized at a subconscious level early in our life with bad ideas, so that you come to a point where you realize, oh, yeah, I have a whole new philosophy of life, a much more positive one, one that gives me what Ayn Rand calls a benevolent sense of life, and yet I'm still emotionally affected by those earlier value judgments that I'm still uprooting from my subconscious and trying to change. Some of it may not be changeable at the end of the day. And So in that sense, it's definitely possible to have emotions that come from one philosophy that you was inculcated earlier on in your life, come to believe a better philosophy, and the two are in opposite ends. But in another sense, of course, sense of life does express, it's the manifestation of philosophy. So in that sense, it's your operative subconscious philosophy. It may not be your conscious philosophy that you cognitively believe is true anymore, but you know, when that changes, your emotions will change too. As I say, of course, there are instances where people's emotions can't always catch up, especially there's an age question here. When did you discover the truth? It can't always fully catch up to it, to your better philosophy. So I would have to say, primarily, yes, there can absolutely be that distinction. But in one sense, the sense of life is the emotional expression of philosophical values that at least at one point we inculcated.
Perfect. Absolutely perfect. In fact, folks can read Leonard's answer, Dr. Peikoff's answer. Yeah, it's so easy to slip into calling Dr. Peikoff Leonard. Of course, you knew him personally, so you're a little more entitled. I've only met him a few times.
I tell you, it took me. Leonard told me, say, call me Leonard early on in our relationship. And I have to say, it took me a couple of years before I could actually do that. He's such an authority to me that I was doctor, he's still doctor, and he would look at me.
Anyway, which doctor you're talking to?
Right.
But I will read the end of Dr. Peikoff's answer, because this is something interesting. He says, you might find interesting in this connection that Ayn Rand identified two different types of fans of hers. There were people who said, well, I love your feeling about life, your sense of life, your heroes, but I don't like your writing. Then there were people who said, well, I love your writing. It's so exact and logical. But I don't like this positive feeling of life, which strikes me as totally unreal. Of those two types, Ayn Rand always said that the one with the good sense of life was a true friend, and the one who claimed to advocate the philosophy but hated the style, the emotion, and the view of life was an enemy, even if unknown to himself. And there were, of course, many fans who liked both her writing and her sense of life. That was interesting to me. But it makes perfect sense considering Ayn Rand's philosophy.
Just using the twist, what's great, I love the fact that you went right to the last bit, because we were talking about, in my example, a person who had maybe started out with a bad sense of life and discovered better ideas. You know, just the opposite is possible. It could be that the sense of life is better, and that maybe you went to college and got corrupted with ideas, and so your explicit philosophy is actually worse than your sense of life, which is actually better and reflective of it. In some cases, it may not be that the person was terribly thoughtful. They have an emotional feeling about Ayn Rand's work. They can't maybe articulate it or understand all the logic of it, but there's something emotional that appeals to them, something profound about their values and their sense of life and their subconscious philosophy to which they're responding. And you can absolutely see Ayn Rand reacting more positively, because the truth obviously is part of your soul. It's built into you. It goes deep. You have really gotten that good part, and this other part is relatively superficial. love that answer.
Well, yeah, I had to read that bit. Now, our fourth question: should the word spiritual, which suggests mysticism, well, before I finish the question, I have to read a super chat from Emmanuel, who was very, very generous. The super chats today are very generous and also great comments. He says, speaking of spirituality, this show, specifically you, Robert and James, provides such spiritual refueling for me. I learn a ton and clarify different challenges in my life. And then he says, small example, Robert's show on gift giving. Oh, thank you. Thank you very much for that, Emmanuel.
I agree, Emmanuel. Robert's show on gift giving is brilliant. I recommend everyone go check it out. And thank you, Emmanuel, so much. My gosh. Yeah, that's exactly it. This is a spiritual value, selfish value. I know the other programming as well is a spiritual value to me. I get so much out of what Robert says. It's just startling to me sometimes. And it means a lot to me. It's a personal selfish value. It makes my world better. But then it's also making the world a better place. Other people can hear this and check this out. And it may take a long time, but we will change the world if we keep talking like this. So it's both at once. There's no conflict here. And there shouldn't be, really. Thank you so much.
Very generous. We also have a couple pounds from Apollo Zeus, who asks a question we might have to save till the end. Here's a question for a whole show on psychology. He says, how malleable is a sense of life? Let's hold that till the end, but thank you for that, Apollo Zeus.
Yeah, interesting. Another interesting question.
We're going to start with, we're going to get the base issues out of the way here, and maybe by the time we're done, we'll have given some answer to that too. Because the fourth question, Leonard Peikoff, was asked that you have selected for us, carefully selected by hand. Should the word spiritual, which Emmanuel referred to, should the word spiritual, which suggests mysticism, be replaced by the word consciousness? Now, Lord knows, again, especially as a newcomer objectivist, I've had this question too. Spiritual, you used the word soul earlier, and we grew up and we're so used to these words being used by religionists and others in very woo ways. So let's see what Leonard Peikoff has to say about this. I'll read the beginning of his answer real quick. He says, they designate two different things. Consciousness is a broad faculty. It's simply the faculty of cognition. And it includes mere perceptual cognition, such as that possessed by animals. It also includes abstract conceptual cognition, which only human beings possess. The spiritual designates the faculty, in this case, the human conceptual faculty, and the values concluded. It makes a big difference whether you say a person's consciousness, their conscious development, or you refer to a person's spiritual development. If you want to develop your consciousness, well, that implies a technical improvement in your means of cognition. You study epistemology, you learn a better method. Well, that's developing your consciousness. But developing your spirit is developing your values, their organization, their hierarchy, their application, their consistency. A man's spirit, therefore, is much fuller and more specific than his consciousness. You could fall in love with a person's spirit, but never with his consciousness. Spirit does not, by the way, imply mysticism. That is simply a corruption, just the same way that people say, well, selfishness implies brutality. There is a legitimate, valid, and necessary concept here, and it has no connection to mysticism. So yes, when we talk about a person's spirit or talk about their soul, you know, Ellsworth Tui, which means Ayn Rand, refers to the style of a soul. Such an insightful phrase.
Yes, because it summarizes that wider scope that the term spirit can get at. You know, I would want to be careful with how a person uses it in today's parlance. Sometimes people mean consciousness to mean every aspect and emanation of human awareness. Ayn Rand almost inevitably uses it in a very technical sense, meaning awareness of reality, perceptual awareness, conceptual awareness, logical analysis, cognition itself, strictly speaking, the consciousness part of the non-physical parts of human beings. And of course, those that other stuff, the conceptual aspect that animals don't share that Leonard talked about, the value aspects, which are themselves at the root of our emotions, that refers to a whole wider scope. Now, they're rooted in cognition. If it weren't for the fact that humans were conceptual, uniquely conceptual in their cognition, none of these aspects of the spirit would be real concepts. I mean, if you're talking about an immortal soul, if you're talking about some mystic quality, some ghost shoved in a machine, objectivism rejects that. It rejects the supernatural. It rejects the immortal soul. It rejects anything but reason as a means of conceptual cognition. So objectivism does not use this. I hate to disappoint, you know, the maybe we teased people wrong title here. Let's get spiritual. It was also a tribute to the recently late Olivia Newton-John too. But the point though is that I don't mean to disappoint people in the sense that a lot of mystics mean spiritual. Objectivists definitely do not mean anything like that. The spirit is a totally natural faculty that we have, but it is more an emanation from the aspect of consciousness that is cognition, knowing. So we'll distinguish consciousness and call consciousness that cognitive knowing part. Whereas, look at all that other stuff, your values, your philosophy. We were talking about your sense of life that emanates from your philosophy, as well as all your other emotions that come from your value judgments. You can crush a soul. You can crush a soul. You can lift a soul. A soul can be uplifted. A soul can be a heroic soul. A style of one's soul can be, you know, ambitious and heroic. The style of another person's soul might be retreating and humble and, you know, not confident. I can talk about broader aspects of my own personality or yours when I bring up things like soul or spirit, but it is a perfectly natural thing. It's not some supernatural thing. And it can only be known and understood by means of reason. And by the way, all those aspects that we're talking about that comprise the spirit are themselves products of the fact that human beings have a conceptual form of cognition. So there's an intimate relationship between these things. But when we use the word, when I use the word spirit or soul, I mean something perfectly natural.
You know, for all the insights we sometimes squeeze out of Stoicism, the last thing we want is that sense of alienation from our passions, from our values.
Exactly.
And alienation really is the word. I did a whole episode reviewing Martha Beck's book, The Way of Integrity, which I called Integrity, This Is the Way, to steal a phrase from The Mandalorian, because that integrity, that being true to yourself, and that doesn't just mean true to your conscious convictions, although that is integrity, but being who you are, really living your values. You need concepts like spiritual or call it soul if you wish, but you're right. In casual conversation, kind of like using the word selfishness, we almost have to define our terms or at least make sure we know what each other mean right at the beginning of the conversation. Yes. And so that makes me want to jump to a similar concept that is can be a little bit rife. Question number five, what about intuition? You learn a lot from it, but it's not mysticism, but it's not reason. And Leonard Peikoff says, people claim it is mysticism. And well, if that's what it were, we'd be totally against it. But yes. But you can use the word for a rational process if you make clear that you don't mean mysticism. Stopping with the answer for a moment there. Again, so many of these words where, because of the dominant philosophies, we have to explain ourselves at the beginning. Well, I'm going to talk to you about intuition, but I'm not talking about random things which you then take action on because they're more important than reason. No. Leonard Peikoff goes on. Intuition simply is the subconscious integration of information, observations, and stored knowledge that you have habituated, that is part of your mind, so that all of the material needed to answer some question is right there, waiting to spring. It's activated, it's known. Then, when any one little dot in reality touches it, any one question, any one fragment, the subconscious will put it all together and come up with an answer. Unquote. I love how Ayn Rand talks about the feeling before that, stomach feelings.
Right, the gut. And that's exactly it. When I hear an argument for the first time, one I've never heard before, I can either have a positive sense or a negative sense. It's like my gut is telling me there's something right about that, or my gut is telling me, oh, there's something wrong about that. But what it is it's an invitation to do thinking. Please unpack that, what your gut is trying to tell you. As Leonard points out, we have a complete storehouse, in effect, of all of the retained knowledge in our subconscious. And it's not, my gosh, it's such a huge sum that it cannot be accessed or retained as a whole by your consciousness. Can't be in the front of your mind, as we might use the phrase, at all times. And so what your gut is telling you are maybe two things. One is, I already know something like this, and I want to call up the knowledge that will make me see this. More than that, it may be a new connection, but similar enough to something you already know. And that, I think, is what's happening too. Our subconscious is doing all kinds of stuff too. And one of the things that it's doing is, if we confront a new situation, there's something similar in our subconscious. Again, I think emotions play a role in this. I know there's something, I heard something that's kind of like that, something that might be related to that, something that might help me get to the answer to that. And that's giving me a gut no or a gut yes. Now, if we have the time to do this thinking, obviously do the thinking. If you're in the middle of a situation and things are happening right now and you have to act, sometimes the stronger gut feeling or the stronger emotion or the concept, the basic concept that I can access first at that is all we have to go on. We can't really demonstrate to ourselves the proof and validation of individual rights. Say the situation involves some individual rights violation. We can't do that, but we shouldn't ignore all that other stored information in our head. It is suggesting things to us. It is telling things to us that we haven't yet brought to conscious identification. That's all intuition, properly understood, means. If you do mean something mystical, yeah. Same with the spirit. If you do mean something like an immortal soul or a supernatural thing or something outside the power of reason, we reject that altogether. But gut feelings are important. Never ignore your gut. Ayn Rand definitely believed in that. She believed that the process of artistic creation itself very much relied on that kind of, she called it, when she would prepare for writing, she would call it stoking her subconscious. So she would get the concretes that would have that emotional connotation, and then in her own mind, unpack the meaning of it, and only then and only then present it in a fictional form. But the gut is critical to so many things, especially our creative work.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because the Ayn Rand's comments on that are all over her writing, but yeah. Especially in what used to be really hard to find and very expensive, and now is available on the internet, The Art of Fiction. If you want advice on stoking your subconscious, on how to build a subconscious that is going to be ripe with fruits for your whether it's essays or creative writing, whatever it is. Harry Binswanger, of course, goes into this in detail in How We Know.
It's amazing. It's like what we were saying before, how emotions can serve as guides. You know, if I was to just go by logic and reason and emotion, I would have a very limited life, a very limited soul, very limited sort of reaction to things. If we are listening to our emotions, if we're listening to our gut, they play. If the whole of our spirit is brought to bear, not just the cognitive aspects of our soul, not just strictly speaking awareness, if we bring all of it to bear, we'll have more of it. If I think more, I'll have more emotional reactions. If I'm attended to my emotional reactions, I will start thinking better. It will guide me right. If the two are working in harmony, no, we don't substitute thinking with emotion. Emotions are not tools of cognition. It ain't logic. It's emotions. It's our pre-existing value judgments. On the other hand, I want to use that well of pre-existing value judgments to help me think. So if I think really deeply, it'll help me feel really profoundly. If I feel really profoundly, it'll help me actually think more clearly. I think that's a really important insight objectivism has.
Yes, and counterintuitive to folks who are new to the philosophy.
Counterintuitive.
But crucially important that you are capitalizing on the whole of who you are, what you know, what you think, what you've taken in, and what you want to put out there.
Some of the best expressions of spirit and body, poetically speaking, that Ayn Rand made are to be found, I think, in her smallest work of fiction, Anthem. This, my body and my soul, this, my body and my spirit. She's using language just like that. On purpose, she used archaic, almost old-fashioned philosophical or religious vocabulary and tonality in that very thing to make this very point. It is a natural phenomenon. But we are integrated beings of spirit and body. We're both. We're all of it. And I just want to get that plug in. Read Anthem if you want a beautiful poetic expression of that.
Absolutely. Apollo Zeus is in the chat reminding us that Lee Pearson has some intelligent and somewhat provocative thoughts on this, the mechanisms by which our intuitions arise. He reminds us Lee Pearson has the concept of inklings. And it's been interesting. I don't know if Lee's going to be coming back to the channel. He's been taking a little bit of time off, but very provocative.
Always fascinating. Yeah, well, that's what I was trying to get at. I'm not sure I understand this as well as Lee, so I recommend everyone checking out Lee. Lee is a brilliant guy, and I hope he does come back for more talks. And sometimes they can be challenging. But that's what the inkling idea was what I was trying to get at before, and Ayn Rand hints at it. You know, there's something there if I'm having an emotion. If my gut is kicking me, if I have a weird feeling, don't never, ever ignore that. There's something going on there. Your subconscious is trying to remind you of something. Now, it may not be right. It may be some traumatic experience that you improperly integrated from childhood or something. You can't totally rely on your emotions. You can't rely on your gut all the time. Sometimes it's leading you astray. But that inkling is really, I think, where it serves me the best. I'll get some feeling. I know there's something wrong there. Yeah, it kind of smells fishy to me. And then I break it down and then yes, of course, it's a reduce it to this was an example of primacy of consciousness or social metaphysics. I knew it. It stunk to me from the outset, but I just couldn't initially identify what it was that was wrong about it. Conversely, something that's good. That sounds right. That sounds like it's onto something important. My subconscious, again, is telling me, give me an inkling. There is some integration that my mind has already done and stored away that's relevant to this. So never ignore it.
Yes. Excellent. There's more to Leonard Peikoff's answer about that, but I think these insights on intuition are crucial and so important, again, to avoid alienating you from yourself, from repressing them, because the more you do that, the harder it is to call on them when you need them. Those of us who think, I know this, but I just can't. And some of us just have poor memories, but I think some of it does come from bad habits, from a psychoepistemology that is not as welcoming to our own intuitions, our own inklings. So certainly, especially for the young people.
You're absolutely right. It's the whole of your being that you have to cherish and foster. That's what's going to give you the motivation and the enjoyment in life anyway. That right. I mean, what's the whole point?
And if I can then, you know, maybe we'll return to this, but I want to get to that question, the super chat question. How malleable is sense of life? And, you know, it's a challenging question. We know sense of life is formed early. We know that it's very, very difficult to change. So how malleable? Well, there's no scale other than to say somewhat. But I can tell you that, you know, for example, in my own case, there was a lot of tragedy in my childhood I won't go into. But yeah, my sense of both my place in the world and what was possible in the world did change substantially over the course of my life. But it's slow. It's difficult. I think the word tortuous comes to mind. How malleable is it? I think the answer has got to be somewhat. And the main advice I would give for anybody out there who is thinking, well, you know, there are aspects of my own psychology that I don't any longer think align with the world, but I still feel them, is A, have patience, and B, don't expect the change to be perfect or 100%. So for all that, I am so different than I was when I was very young. In some ways, I'm exactly the same. Some of those things I would like to change, but, and here's my take-home point for this for folks, psychology is a thing. We are more right. than just our conclusions.
Right. You know something, I want to put something, what I wanted to answer there on that was that I am grateful that my sense of life was malleable. And I think the malleability of, I think it's more malleable the younger we are, obviously. The older we get, the more cast in concrete I think our psychology and emotions become, especially if we don't introspect and attend to it self-consciously. But there is, even in that difference, I think there's differences in malleability. The ability to have a malleable sense of life, I think, is a good one, because the more deeply set and unchallengeable our emotions are, maybe the more it reflects trauma or something that, you know, so to a degree. Now, I don't think you should be infinitely malleable, because I'm not. Some of my values now I'm so confident, so certain of, that that emotional result is, it may as well be the evaluation itself. I'm so confident in that emotion. So I don't think, you know, total plasticity is a good thing. But let me just suggest a rule of thumb. The less malleable some aspect is of a young person's sense of life, the more likely it is to represent something bad, some pain, some trauma, some subconscious thing that wasn't good about their childhood. So becoming more malleable is itself a good thing, although we don't want to be infinitely malleable. It's not even a value. But on the other hand, it's that degree of malleability, especially when we're young, that may itself be the issue. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. And for people who find that fact of reality a hard swallow, one thing I can tell you is, at least in my own personal experience, there's consolation in the fact that you are not infinitely malleable, because otherwise it would be very tough to have a sense of identity.
Right.
I'm not infinitely malleable.
Yeah. And my current values are my current values. My current sense of life is my current sense of life. I have to accept that as a given too. If I know, hey, I'm working on this part of it, or I can change this aspect of it. But the fact that you can't change every aspect of your, I mean, we were talking, for example, about something as deep as sexual orientation. Oh, please, don't even try and fight that. There's more misery in the attempt to fight that than the potential joy you can get. And so long as it's a values oriented, serious, you know, rights respecting, honest kind of relationship, that's more important than being able to change every aspect of your, some aspects of your psychology. It just makes better sense. Even if you look, I know where that came from. It's weird. Just a strange thing about myself. There's no need to change everything from your personal context. Your personal context makes you, in part, as well as your own thinking, the unique being that you are. So unless it's causing a problem in your life, causing unhappiness or your inability to function or cope with something, then I would definitely look into it. I think you have a responsibility to look into how malleable or unmalleable it is. But the fact that some things are just not very malleable, And we can just accept that about ourselves. Look, if I like, something that's actually maybe a lesser value, but still a value, what's wrong with valuing that value? I'm not going to change that about myself. I'll go for the higher value too. But the point is, the fact that you can't, it's not infinitely valuable, is not a tragedy. It's not a tragedy. If it is a tragic thing, it's causing you pain and dysfunction. That's when I would say you absolutely have to do something about it. Probably seek professional help. And a final comment about the term spiritual. If someone says, oh, well, let's be spiritual, as we say, being spiritual. Oh, wait a minute here. So you're saying there are people who are more or less spiritual. That, I think, is a dubious use of it. You see? We're all spiritual. We all have spirits. Spirit is a descriptive term. It's not an aspiration. Oh, I want to be more spiritual. No, we are all spiritual.
Yes.
So in my mind, that's how I hear the difference. The spirit is broken or the spirit is uplifted. I buy that. Your spirit is heroic or your spirit is malevolent. I buy that. If someone says to me, oh, let's get more spiritual, like the song would be, like the turning on the Olivia Newton-John song, let's get spiritual. That's the use, the context of spiritual use that I would find dubious.
Excellent. Excellent. Yeah. On that point of malleability, just to reinforce, you don't want to be that malleable.
No.
To the point where, again, you lose identity. I was going to co-write, this never happened, but a work of fiction earlier in my life. We were writing a story called Beggar's Ride, in which somebody wakes up one morning and finds that he has that power of the kind of godlike power of making wishes come true. And what a complete nightmare that would be in all the ways that it would be. The title Beggar's Ride comes from the phrase, if wishes were horses, beggars would ride. And right. Imagine if you could just will anything that you wanted to have happen. And you would start out small, you would make little nice things happen, or you would will yourself wealth. But then you would, you'd start wishing bad things out of existence, and you'd make mistakes, and you'd want to bring those things back, but your memory is only so good. Eventually you would distort reality in so many ways that you would create a nightmare for yourself. If there is no identity to the world, then there's ultimately no identity to yourself. No, you don't want to be infinitely malleable.
By no means.
And so if you're like me and you've faced challenges and you've had to make changes in your life and you've thought, oh man, I wish this hadn't happened, that hadn't happened. The musician Christopher Smith in the chat says, careful what you wish for. Is it wrong that I always point out the musicians in the chat? Are musicians necessarily better people than the rest of us? I've got to get over that bias. But yes, be careful what you wish for. I am glad in a way that it's aspects of my psychology are stubborn. I want them to be stubborn. I want those wins to be hard fought because I need that solidity.
Yeah. There's a wonderful old Twilight Zone episode where a criminal dies and he's sent to the afterlife and everything is just wonderful. He's getting everything he wants. He's winning every game he plays. Beautiful women are throwing themselves at him. He's rich and living in a luxury apartment. And so he figures he must have gone to hell, but soon he realizes there's no challenge to anything. Soon he realizes there's nothing to change or grow or be. It's just all being handed to him on a silver plate, causelessly, automatically, like some magic. And then suddenly he realizes, this is boring. I can't, no, wait a minute. I can't, this isn't human life to me. This is why should I have, this isn't hell. He tells the guy, the angelic presence who's sort of helping him along, says, and the Sebastian Cabot saying, well, what made you think this was heaven?
Yeah.
He realizes that that's what hell consists of, is getting everything you want automatically. No, obviously, it evades the basic law of cause and effect. The basic reason why, the causal, ultimate causal reason why we have emotions, getting back to that earlier question, we have emotions to motivate us. We do not have an automatic existence. A, unfortunately, is limited to A and causes causality. You can't just, say a magic formula and get the answer. You can't skip cause and effect. In fact, our whole being is a understanding and a confrontation of the fact that we are a limited thing with an identity living in a world that is causal. And, you know, the belief and desire for magic really is the desire to live in a causeless world in which A can be not A according to our whim. But to get the kind of happiness we have in life requires the enactment of certain causes to get certain effects. Achievement itself depends upon that and that limitation. So yeah, I don't think it's metaphysically possible. Could you be omnipotent or omniscient? If someone were even though, I wouldn't want it. I wouldn't want it. What would be life? I mean,
it's funny. I have a T-shirt picture of a man lounging on a cloud, throwing a paper airplane. It says, "Heaven is boring." And I almost wonder if that Twilight Zone episode wasn't smuggling in that idea that even if that wasn't hell, presumably heaven is where you have no pains, no needs, no wants, no what? That would be boring after a year, much less an eternity.
Right.
Fortunately, it's not real. It doesn't exist. Right. But
the whole concept of eternity scares me as such.
I wouldn't want eternity,
you know, maybe, you know, 10,000 years or something, but eternity, really think about eternity, people. I guess forever and ever and ever, which is, of course, a contradiction to ASA, and so fortunately cannot be.
Outstanding. Well, I have two takeaways from this episode. Maybe I have three takeaways from this episode. Psychology is a thing. You are bigger than reason and emotion, and that's a beautiful thing. The Fountainhead presents an ideal man, but also an ideal perspective on evil. And I love that, trying to be more like Rourke. In that particular way of your relationship to the world, I said before, you've got a world full of evil and bad things, and we can see all the things that are wrong. And even if it's true that the world is in decline, which I don't believe, your next question should be, okay, now what am I going to do? What am I going to do with this life I've got? And why should all the rest of that matter any more than, I mean, it matters when you pay your taxes. It matters when you confront evil and you do it and you fight it and you get really angry. But then, okay, now what am I going to do with this life?
Well, what a brilliant insight, Robert. Really, that's outstanding. That's exactly it. That's exactly it. We are so much more. And psychology is a distinct science. One last note I might want to throw in. Yeah. Psychology is way bigger than the subject, one little aspect of consciousness. And its philosophy doesn't go into a lot of these areas of psychology and has no answer to it. But philosophy does provide us a good epistemological and moral base for understanding ourselves. And if you want to know, see a hero who possesses the noblest of spirits, but is also a successful practical actor in this world, read about Howard Rourke in The Fountainhead.
Outstanding. Yeah, if anybody hasn't read that book, I know a book will change your life. That book will change your life.
It will.
But it's such a fun read. Oh my God. I want to read it just for the fun. It's such a good story to be in. James, thank you so much. I think we can agree that, yes, spiritual or our souls are much broader than reason and emotion. Properly established, probably at the beginning of a conversation, they are not necessarily mystical or subjective in any way whatsoever. And ultimately, I think we need to embrace all of these aspects of ourselves. I'm looking forward to doing this again next Wednesday, peak off Wednesdays. But James, I know you've got work to do on the Daily Objective, so I think it's time for us to let you go. Everybody, if you are not already supporting the Ayn Rand Center UK, link is at the top. Become a member. Keep off the super chats. We're so generous today. Jeff Bannister and Emmanuel, thank you so much for your generosity, and not just during this show. Everybody, I love what we do here. I hope you love what we do here. Please keep supporting the ARC UK.
For the Daily Objective today, I'm going to be talking with Mark Pellegrino about artificial intelligence and the new chat program that people have been talking about. And we have a lot to say about that. Please join us.
I am looking forward to that. I have a lot of opinions on that. And I know we've talked a bit about it, so I know that you share some of the same ideas I do. It really is something that, well, I'm looking forward to hearing what you and Mark bring to the table. It's going to be good. Folks, we will see you next Wednesday. Thanks for joining us. Have an outstanding morning, afternoon, wherever in the world you are, and join us in less than an hour for the Daily Objective.
Love you. Take care.